And we believe that what's going against Venezuela currently, no international serious action is taken. It could be set a precedent for law breaking at the international level, at the world level.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei, in his weekly briefing, also condemned Israel's continued operations in Gaza and the West Bank. He said nearly 400 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza since a fragile ceasefire was announced. Baghaei criticized Washington's new national security strategy, saying it openly prioritizes Israel's security in the West Asia region. He also protested the U.S.'s refusal to issue visas for Iranian delegates attending the FIFA World Cup draw. Baghaei said the host country is required under international rules to ensure access for all participating teams. Well, Iran's parliament speaker has once again condemned as unfounded and baseless claims made by the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council over three Iranian islands, calling them inseparable part of the country.
These ridiculous and baseless claims, which are generally pushed by other countries, are in contradiction with the principle of respect for the territorial integrity of countries and good neighborliness.
Ghalibaf warned Iran's neighbors in the Persian Gulf not to test the will of the Iranian nation in defending its territorial integrity, especially the Iranian islands in the Persian Gulf. He stressed that Iran has always sought to promote peace and respect for the principles of good neighborliness and therefore expects the same behavior from its neighbors. His remarks came after the PGCC, in its latest statement, renewed the UAE's claims over three Iranian islands of Bumusa and the Greater and Lesser Tombas. Tehran has repeatedly rejected the Arab country's claims over the islands, which have historically been part of Iran. Iran's ambassador in Tunis has handed over an official invitation letter from Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi to his Tunisian counterpart. This comes as the two countries seek to expand their bilateral ties and diplomatic relations. Iskandar Nuar reports from Tunis.
Iran is stepping up its diplomatic efforts in Tunisia. The Iranian ambassador, Mir Masoud Husseinian, delivered a formal invitation from Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi following several high-level meetings, including talks with Tunisia's president and the foreign ministers of both nations. The letter invites Tunisian officials to visit Iran to exchange expertise and strengthen bilateral ties.
This invitation aims to enhance cooperation in political, cultural, and economic fields, building on the successful meetings our officials have had so far.
Iran's ambassador referred to the Tunisian president's previous meetings with Iran's foreign minister, describing them as a highly successful, noting that the discussions addressed key issues of mutual interest and were met with a positive reception.
President Kais Saied is well versed in Iranian laws, rights and culture. With knowledge spanning hundreds of years, he had previously met with the Iranian foreign minister, during which he demonstrated his understanding of issues important to the Iranian people. The meeting was very successful, and all matters were positively received.
Analysts say this rapprochement is strategic, reflecting Iran's growing regional influence and Tunisia's interest in strengthening ties with Tehran.
This rapprochement is no coincidence. It stems from Iran's rise as a regional power and Tunisia's willingness to engage on shared political, economic, and social issues, including support for Palestine.
Experts also emphasize that the diplomatic engagement is grounded in shared stances on regional conflicts and international politics.
On the political and international level, especially regarding the Palestinian cause and resistance against Israel, these shared principles guide the growing Tunisia-Iran relations.
Cultural exchange, joint expertise programs, and increased dialogue signal a new phase in bilateral relations. Both countries appear determined to build closer ties amid shifting regional dynamics. Iran is stepping up its outreach to Tunis, delivering a formal message from Foreign Minister Araghchi as both countries move closer diplomatically. The letter marks a new phase in their growing political alignment. Iskandar Nawar, Tunis.
While on the ground, Israeli forces continue to violate the ceasefire agreement with Hamas in the Gaza Strip, killing and injuring more civilians across the war-torn territory. In its latest attacks, the Israeli military has killed a Palestinian civilian in central Gaza. A Palestinian child was also injured by the regime's army gunfire in the Al-Tufah neighborhood northeast of Gaza City. Al-Maghazi refugee camp in the central Gaza Strip was also targeted by airstrikes. The regime also continued its policy of destruction in the Palestinian territory by demolishing several more residential buildings in eastern Khan Yunis. Since the ceasefire took effect on October the 10th, over 370 Palestinians have been killed in the regime's attacks, with children, women, and the elderly making up the majority of the victims. The death toll from the Israeli genocide now exceeds 70,350, with over 171,000 others injured. The suffering of the Palestinian patients diagnosed with glaucoma has been exacerbated as a result of Israel's genocidal policy. The patients were not allowed to leave Gaza as the Rafah crossing was closed. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabih reports from Deir al-Balah.
As the Israeli regime continues to violate the ceasefire deal, more repercussions continue to unfold for Palestinians amid an already catastrophic humanitarian situation. The Gaza Health Ministry announced that more than 4,000 Palestinian patients diagnosed with glaucoma disease are prevented from leaving the Gaza Strip. Those patients are in immense need to travel abroad to get the medical treatment. Otherwise, they are at risk of losing their sight. Glaucoma is an eye condition that damages the optic nerve. This damage can lead to vision loss or blindness. Damage to the optic nerve is often related to high pressure in the eye. According to doctors, those patients need to travel as soon as possible to avoid further deterioration in their health conditions.
We have at least 4,000 patients suffering from glaucoma. Undoubtedly, their suffering has been exacerbated by many factors. The first one is the lack of essential medications as a result of preventing those supplies from entering Gaza by Israel.
The glaucoma patients joined the list of more than 18,000 patients trapped in Gaza with no permits to leave, and they still face life-threatening consequences. The suffering of the Palestinian patients continues to worsen as the Israeli regime remains adamant in violating the ceasefire deal. According to Gazans, the truce mediators must take responsibilities and stop those violations. Abu Musabih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
A prominent international hacker group has declared a reward of $10,000 for any Israelis, 11 Israelis involved in the design and operation of the regime's Iron Dome missile interceptor system. Handala hackers say the reward will be paid for information that leads to, quote, location or the apprehension of each of the Israeli operatives. The hacker group has been leaking details about scores of Israeli security, military, and intelligence operatives over the past weeks. These are people mostly involved in the recent Israeli aggression against Iran and the genocide in Gaza. They are included in the group's so-called Red Wanted list and are warned of a harsh punishment for their crimes. Well, thousands of demonstrators have held another weekly protest in the occupied territories to condemn the Israeli Prime Minister's Gaza policy. They also demanded an independent committee to be established to investigate the regime's security failures in October 2023. In Tel Aviv, demonstrators voiced anger over what they described as Benjamin Netanyahu's attempt to avoid accountability for October the 7th. Protesters accused the Israeli Prime Minister of seeking to handpick members of the proposed investigation committee, a move they say would politicize the process and shield officials from responsibility. In addition to demands for an independent inquiry, many in the crowd also criticized the regime's refusal to require military service for ultra-Orthodox men, calling it another example of unequal treatment. Organizers stressed that they will continue to rally until a transparent and impartial investigation is guaranteed. Israeli forces have killed two young Palestinians in the occupied West Bank after they carried out a resistance operation against the regime's forces. According to Israeli media, the shooting took place in Bab al-Zawiya area of Al-Khalil. They said one soldier was wounded, though details of his injuries remain unclear. Witnesses said the two Palestinians were killed instantly as Israeli forces fired directly at their car. The regime's forces then prevented ambulance crews from reaching the scene, sealed off the area, and abducted the bodies of the slain Palestinians. The incident is the latest in a series of violent Israeli incursions, which have left many Palestinians dead and led to the abduction of many others across the occupied territory. Hamas hailed the operation as a response to the regime's ongoing aggression and daily crimes against Palestinians and their holy sites in the West Bank. In other news, Russian forces have launched a large-scale attack, striking energy infrastructure across Ukraine and causing widespread blackouts. Ukrainian officials say a massive overnight barrage of drones and missiles hit eight regions, damaging power and heating facilities and forcing nuclear plants to reduce output. Moscow confirmed that it called a massive strike, saying it was in retaliation for Ukrainian attacks inside of Russia. The escalation comes as diplomatic efforts continue. 3 days of talks between Ukrainian and U.S. officials in Miami produced no clear breakthrough. President Volodymyr Zelensky said he joined negotiators for a, quote, substantive and constructive call with U.S. envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. The U.S. envoys also met President Putin in Moscow earlier on Tuesday. A decision by FIFA to grant its new peace prize to U.S. President Donald Trump has sparked immediate backlash. Critics say the move is in violation of the sporting body's supposed commitment to political neutrality. They also highlighted FIFA's hypocrisy in its refusal to ban Israel from the world football over its genocide in Gaza. We have more details in this report.
Players frequently face fines and bans from FIFA for expressing political messages, as the football governing body has long championed a policy of political neutrality. Yet on Friday, FIFA President Gianni Infantino awarded the inaugural FIFA Peace Prize to U.S. President Donald Trump. While presenting the prize, Infantino expressed support for Trump's international deals, including the so-called Abraham Accords that established formal ties between Israel and several Arab states without resolving the question of Palestinian statehood. Infantino has previously warned against using football to stoke division, saying that the political neutrality of sports should be protected. 2 years later, critics point out that he created a prize to celebrate peace and unity and then handed it to a president who called people from Somalia garbage just days prior and has advocated for increased military spending across the Western world. Trump also ordered the bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities in June and continues to arm Israel despite the ongoing genocide against Palestinians. Trump's administration has also carried out airstrikes against vessels near Venezuela. At home, the U.S. president has intensified an anti-immigration crackdown that has led to the detention and attempted deportation of non-citizens. Some advocates have been targeted for their criticism of Israel. A group of international activists who campaigned for suspending Israel from the world football have released a statement calling the award to Trump a shameful development. They also accused FIFA and UEFA of double standards over their failure to act against Israel in the 2 years of its war on Gaza, while swiftly sanctioning Russia following the breakout of the war in Ukraine in 2022. Infantino has refused to take action against Israel, arguing that football cannot solve geopolitical issues. the apparent preferential treatment of Israel calls into question the integrity of FIFA's supposed commitment to political neutrality, as FIFA continues to tout football as a unifying force on the global stage, it must now confront mounting accusations of hypocrisy and double standards that threaten its credibility.
United States President Donald Trump came to power promising to stop America's endless wars, but he is on the cusp of starting another one in Venezuela. Protesters came out in cities across the United States to stop the escalating aggression of Washington towards the oil-rich nation. Rahman Mazahiri reports from Washington, D.C.
Across the United States, protests were held against a major air and missile attack on Venezuela, which appears closer and closer. Washington has already carried out dozens of airstrikes, killing nearly 100 people, and assembled the largest U.S. armada in Latin American waters since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. United States President Donald Trump blamed Venezuela, without evidence, for being the primary source of America's drug problems. But many believe it's their socialist-inspired government, which capitalist imperialist Washington cannot allow. Many say that Venezuela is too strong for a ground invasion, even after decades of brutal Western sanctions that have sought to strangle the population and foment civil war. Trump's aggression towards Venezuelans is a direct contradiction of his anti-war campaign promises and a continuation of decades of neoliberalism. As the United States has failed across the Middle East, they appear to be pulling back their imperialist aggression to what they consider their own backyard, Latin America. Apart from being socialist-inspired, Venezuela sits on the world's largest oil reserves. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now.
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum, dear brother and sister. Welcome. This is today's special from IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for choosing this program to listen to, where we're going to speak about living a blessed life.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light. You guides me through my darkest nights. Shows me right from wrong. In the world that often lies, cause I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Today is Sunday, 16th of Jamadil Thani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri Calendar, corresponding to the 16th of the month of Azar, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 7th of December, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. For blessing this moment, we listen to chapter Al-Ma'idah, verse 23.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. قال رجلان من الذين يخافون أنعم الله عليهم ادخلوا عليهم الباب فإذا دخلتموه فإنكم غالبون وعلى الله فتوكلوا إن كنتم
Said two men from those who feared to disobey upon whom Allah had bestowed favor, enter upon them through the gate, for when you have entered it, you will be predominant, and upon Allah rely, if you should be believers.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
As the Quranic commentary books indicate, those two men who are mentioned in the verse were from among those 12 chiefs of the Israelites. By the way, fearing Allah is the cause for absorbing the favors of Allah and His bounties. So the one who is in awe of Allah does not fear any other might, and therefore he must rely only on Allah.
Shukran ya Rabbi, shukran.
شكرًا يا ربي شكرًا هديت قلبي شكرًا نورت دربي شكرًا شكرًا يا ربي يا منزل القرآن يا خالق الإنسان يا ربي يا رحمن شكرًا يا.
The topic of this episode of today's special is how to live a blessed life. Dear brother, dear sister, life is good, and every day the eyes open to the light of the sun and the moon is granted blessing, one that must be thanked for and utilized. Building strong ties with the world and its affairs is something a mature Muslim cares about. As long as there is breath in his chest, his utmost duty is to conduct himself well on this earth, upon which Allah has made him a wise gerent. Living longer and remaining on this earth is not an evil, rather it raised a man's rank. A long life can indeed be a source of precious goods. The claim that life is evil and that living it is better than enduring it is nothing but nonsense, completely disconnected from Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, today we have another topic to discuss about. If life is a blessing, are we looking at the life as a blessing? The philosophy of religion asks whether life's value depends on a relationship to something beyond the world, such as God or transcendent good. Many religion philosophers argue that if humans are created with a purpose, then life is inherently precious, even when individuals cannot see the full picture. This view does not erase suffering, but situates it within a larger narrative of creation, fall, redemption, and hope. Such approaches often claim that human beings bear a special dignity, sometimes expressed in terms like image of God. If this is true, then every human life reflects, however imperfectly, something of divine wisdom, creativity, and love. Life is a blessing not only because of what people can do, but because of what they are in their deepest nature. In many strands of Christianity, life is explicitly described as a gift from Allah. Both in its physical and spiritual dimensions, God is seen as the author of life. So to receive life is to receive something willed, known, and loved by its giver. This is why concepts such as the sanctity of life are fundamental.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio.
May this moment last forever in your heart, a day you'll always remember every part.
Today's special.
This feeling of love, just let it grow forever through your life. Bring beautiful years of joy between you till the end of time.
One vital question, how can we attain the good life? Islam offers us battling the inner self or nafs. What do I mean? In our journey to Allah, the initial stages will feel very difficult at times. We have to preserve and keep going until our hearts become attached to Allah. Once our hearts are attached to Allah, the acts of worship will no longer feel difficult and we will begin to enjoy them. A scholar said, I forced my nafs or inner self to go to Allah whilst it was crying until I was able to take it to Him whilst it was laughing. By performing all the obligatory deeds and additional voluntary deeds, we can reach to a good life. In a Hadith Qudsi, Allah states, My servant continues to draw close to me with voluntary deeds until I love him. What action increase barakah in one's life? It is not surprising that Quran is one of the greatest sources of barakah for the believers, as Allah says about it in the Holy Quran, chapter 38, verse 29, a blessed book which we have revealed to you so that they may contemplate its verses and people of reason may be mindful. Although the entire Quran is blessed and a source of barakah, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, specified in one's hadith, recite Surah Baqarah. For doing so leads to barakah, and abandoning it leads to great and loss. If one reads Surah Baqarah, it becomes a source of blessings in one's time. Of course, the test for the servant is knowing that Surah Baqarah is the lengthiest surah in the Quran, and yet it is the one singled out in the hadith as being a source of blessings. Many times people memorize or recite Baqarah without realizing that it was a cause of great blessings in their lives, but they had not associated those blessings with the surah.
Another dimension of life as a blessing appears in the way human beings are relational by nature. Many philosophical and religious accounts describe human as incomplete in isolation and fulfilled through loving, just, and trustful relationships. In this light, life is blessing not only because of individual achievements, but because it enables bonds of family, friendship, community, and worship. Communal rituals, festivals, assemblies, gatherings, and the acts of services reinforce this by turning life's milestones and ordinary days into occasions of shared gratitude. People often experience life as the most blessed when they are giving and receiving care, forgiveness, or encouragement. These interactions affirm that life's value is not purely private, but is woven into a shared moral and emotional world. Bringing these strands together shows that calling life a blessing can mean several connected things: that human existence has intrinsic value, that it offers the possibility of virtue and wisdom, that is a gift or trust from a higher source, and that an attitude of gratitude and responsibility enhances well-being. None of these claims erase the reality of suffering, injustice, or personal struggle. Instead, they propose that even in a fragile and painful world, there remains something profoundly good about being alive, capable of knowing, loving, and seeking truth. For someone asking whether life is a blessing, this deep exploration suggests a response that is both honest and hopeful. Life can be recognized and lived as a blessing when its value is affirmed, its responsibilities are embraced, and its hardships are faced with courage, meaning, and gratitude. Thank you very much, dear brothers and sisters, for staying tuned and listening to us, and staying tuned with Arab English Radio. Till then, I'll live in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of today's special, which in that way speak about a blessed life and the ways, of course. Follow us. Thank you, and fi amanillah.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Rabbi, Muhammad Nabi, Aliyun Imami, Lafata illa Aliyun Imami. علي إمامي علي إمامي
لا إله إلا الله الله ربي
محمد نبي علي إمامي
لا فتى إلا علي علي إمامي علي إمامي
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The hopes of the Palestinian people in Gaza to have a meaningful ceasefire are fading away amid the rising violations that have become a daily routine since the U.S. brokered deal came into effect. Until the moment of writing this report, more than 300 Palestinians lost their lives while hundreds others got wounded in the frequent violations and major escalations carried out by the Israeli forces. Those violations include the aerial and artillery strikes, mass shootings, and on top of that, the demolition of the Palestinian houses located in the areas beyond the so-called yellow demarcation line. Mahmoud Adoura, a 16-year-old boy from Al-Burwaj camp, was one of those victims who was targeted by the Israeli forces as he was trying to collect some wood pieces for his family to cook what to eat. To those who don't know Mahmoud, he is the youngest brother of the well-known martyr Muhammad Adoura, who was shot dead in his father's lap by the Israeli forces near Netzarim Junction live on air before the eyes of the whole world during the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Since that moment, Adoura's name has become a vivid testament of the brutality of the Israeli regime. Today, we are going to shed some light on the details of suffering that Mahmoud, like thousands of injuries, has been through since he was injured so far.
I'm Mahmoud Al-Durra, 16 years old. I was navigating along my friends in the eastern side of Al-Burraish camp to gather some wood in order to help my family. We used to do that for the last months. As I was walking there, suddenly I was shot in the leg. I tried to escape, but I fell down. Israeli forces came and kidnapped me alongside many friends of mine. Once they saw me, they identified me and told me that I am the son of Jamal Al-Durra. I was blindfolded and handcuffed tightly before the soldiers began to beat me savagely with their boots and fists. I was taken in one of their vehicles to an unknown destination. All along the way, they kept beating and insulting my father and me with all nasty abuses. They threatened me with killing my family.
In late of October, Mahmoud got out of our home to bring some wood we used to ignite the cooking fire, like all families of Gaza Strip do. I received a phone call informing me that Mahmoud had been shot and was seriously injured. We feared for his life, worried not only that he might die, but also that the dogs might tear him apart. In the afternoon, I received a phone call from the ambulance driver, who told me that Mahmoud had been released and was injured. I rushed to Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah. When I saw him, it was clear that he had been brutally beaten, with obvious signs of torture. In addition to the physical abuse, they insulted him, telling him that they had destroyed his home.
On the day Mahmoud was shot, I had a strong feeling that something was going to go wrong. I warned him several times, telling him I had a bad feeling and didn't want him to go. But he insisted on leaving, saying he wouldn't be far from home. When we received the call that he had been shot by the Israeli forces, all sorts of terrible thoughts raced through my mind. I feared that he would be left to die and eaten by stray dogs, or that the Israeli forces would abduct his body. My mind was filled with dark scenarios. To me, it felt like a miracle that Mahmoud survived, and I'm just grateful that he's still alive.
Although Mahmoud was only in Israeli custody for less than 24 hours, The horrifying details he and his family shared make it difficult to imagine the conditions that Palestinian prisoners and detainees have endured for decades inside Israeli jails.
One of the soldiers stuck his finger into the bullet wound in my leg, taking pleasure in hearing me scream from the pain. After that, another soldier opened a soda bottle and poured it into my injury. I endured more than 9 hours of relentless beating and insults with no break. Every time I asked for water, they would pour it over my head instead. At one point, one of the soldiers even stretched my arm out as if to cut it off, but the officer stopped him before he could.
Once Mahmoud arrived at Al-Aqsa Hospital, even more agonizing consequences began to unfold, revealing how the Israeli soldiers had deliberately caused the injury to his leg, leading to its amputation.
I was in shock when the doctor told me that Mahmoud's leg needed to be amputated, or he would face life-threatening consequences. I begged him to do whatever he could to avoid the amputation and save his leg. Mahmoud underwent several surgeries, but sadly, all attempts were in vain. The doctor explained that the Israeli forces had deliberately treated his injury in a way that would lead to amputation. I couldn't believe that Mahmoud might lose his leg, and I burst into tears.
It was clear that he had been through hell in custody. He was insulted and brutally beaten. He told me that he would have preferred death over the humiliation and dehumanization he suffered at the hands of the Israeli soldiers. They deliberately caused the injury that led to his leg being amputated. They denied him food and water and refused to provide proper first aid. Can you imagine all of this being done to a 16-year-old boy? What happened to Mahmoud reminds me of what happened to his brothers, Mohammed and Ahmad, and to so many Palestinians who have been killed or mistreated by Israeli forces.
If all of this could happen to a 16-year-old boy who was only trying to gather some pieces of food, then what must the situation be like for the men, women, and community leaders of the Palestinian people? It's no surprise that many Palestinians feel that Israeli forces act with the spirit of retaliation and collective punishment, affecting even civilians who have done nothing wrong. For many Palestinians, the lived reality is that simply being Palestinian can expose a person to violence, humiliation, or abuse. And for those who choose to resist or stand against the Israeli regime, the consequences can be even more severe, sometimes extending to their families as well.
It was very clear that they shot me and took me because I am the brother of Muhammad al-Durra. They wanted to take revenge on my father for exposing them to the world. They told me explicitly that they were going to kill my family after destroying our home.
I know for certain that they targeted him because he is my son. They wanted to punish me for exposing their actions after the horrific crime they committed against my son, Mohammed, who was shot dead by Israeli forces while I tried to shield him with my own arms. There was no October 7th then. What happened to Mohammed was part of the ongoing violence and brutality that we continue to witness today in Gaza and elsewhere. In addition to Mohammed, the Israeli forces killed another one of my sons during the current war on Gaza. They also killed my brothers and destroyed my home. These crimes were committed simply because they see me as a problem for them, someone who refuses to stay silent. I have taken legal action against them in several countries, and they are trying to settle their scores with me.
It has become undeniable that everything the Israeli regime does to the Palestinian people, and every crime it commits against Palestinian children in particular, occurs within a specific context: deterrence. The Israeli regime believes that by committing these crimes, it will enforce the Palestinian people to their knees, pushing them to give up their legitimate rights. However, the reality is the opposite. The Palestinian people continue to show defiance in the face of Israeli brutality. and their determination to resist occupation is growing stronger with each passing day.
I want to send a clear message to Netanyahu and the Israeli military. I will remain steadfast in raising the voice of the Palestinian people and pursuing accountability for the occupation until justice is finally served. No matter what has been done to us, our will cannot be broken. We are the indigenous people of this land, and we are fighting for our legitimate rights. Today, the entire world has become fully aware that the Israeli regime functions as a colonial system built on oppression. What has taken place in Gaza is a catastrophe of historic proportions. They targeted journalists, paramedics, and civil defense workers. No one was spared. Entire neighborhoods and essential services were destroyed.
It is truly heartbreaking that the killing continues even after the announcement of a ceasefire. Shortly after Mahmoud was shot, two other children from the same area were killed under similar circumstances. The targeting of children has become a devastating and recurring reality for our community. No mother anywhere in the world could bear the sight of her child losing a leg. Despite everything that continues to happen to us in Gaza, we remain steadfast. We will never give up our right to resist the occupation and to seek freedom and dignity.
Shooting Mahmoud will not be the last crime committed by Israeli forces, but it stands as yet another testament to the brutality Palestinians continue to face. An attempt to subjugate our people through fear and violence. Yet the Palestinian people will never bow or submit to the occupation. Our resolve remains unbroken.
Every night.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear listeners, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. You know, justice is the pillar of every society. When this pillar cracks, the whole structure eventually collapses. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his holy progeny, once warned that the destruction of the nations before you was because it may have been addressing Imam Ali alayhi salam, talking to him. The destruction of the nations before you was because if a noble among them stole, they let him go. But if a weak one, stole, they punished him. So, dear brothers and sisters, this is a very, very relevant hadith to our societies today. In other words, the Holy Prophet is saying that double standards and selective justice are among the surest ways a community destroys itself from within. Think about it. When people see that the powerful can get away with crimes while the poor and voiceless face the full weight of the law, what happens? Trust evaporates. Ordinary people begin to lose faith in institutions, and society becomes divided between the privileged and the oppressed. Modern research in sociology confirms this. Studies on corruption and inequality show that societies with unfair legal systems experience higher crime rates, weaker economies, and even shorter life expectancy. In fact, according to a World Bank report, corruption and biased justice can reduce a nation's economic growth by as much as 1 to 2% every year. We see this around the world. In some countries, wealthy individuals commit massive financial fraud and escape with a fine or no punishment at all. Meanwhile, someone poor might end up in prison for stealing food to survive. History tells us the same story. The Roman Empire, for example, weakened as corruption and favoritism spread. The same pattern repeated in other civilizations that collapsed when justice was replaced with privilege. But this teaching isn't only about governments and courts, it's also about us in our daily lives. Do we apply fairness equally to our children, our friends, our co-workers, or do we make excuses for those we like while being harsh on those we don't? This is very delicate, my friends. Even in families, when kids feel that rules apply differently depending on who they are, resentment grows. Psychologists know that consistency in discipline and fairness in treatment are key to building trust and emotional health in children. So here is the takeaway. If we want strong, lasting communities, we must commit ourselves to fairness, whether we are leaders, parents, teachers,